Turn, please, in the Old Testament to Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Chapter 7 begins the second part of the book. If you were to analyze the book, it falls into two parts, 1 to 6 and 7 to 12. In chapter 7 to 12, although they carry through the theme of the first six chapters, more simply assume the first six chapters. And it's written to people who now understand that we have no hope under the sun in this vain world, and we must trust in God. And it's instruction, so having gotten that, how should we live? I'm going to read first from Ephesians chapter 5, verses 15 to 17. See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. Therefore, do not be unwise, but understand what the will of the Lord is. One might say the first six chapters of Ecclesiastes were devoted to establishing this fact. The days are evil, and they are short. So then, how should those who fear the Lord live? And we have the answer in Ecclesiastes in the next six chapters. Now, the first 14 verses go together as a unit, and I'm going to read all 14, and as far as we get this morning, we'll stop, and then we'll finish this afternoon up through verse 14. Before we read God's word, let's ask his help and blessing. Our God in heaven, we are often proud before you without even realizing our pride. As we sometimes say, tomorrow I will do this and that, and forget to remember that tomorrow, according to your will, we will do this and that. And so we do pray this morning as we read your word that you will remind us that you are God and that we are not. And in this way will humble us and make us wise. And this we ask in Christ's name. Amen. Chapter 7, verses 1 through 14. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. Better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by a sad countenance the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools, for like the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity. Surely oppression destroys a wise man's reason, and a bribe debases the heart. The end of a thing is better than its beginning. The patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Do not hasten in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools. Do not say, why were the former days better than these? For you do not inquire wisely concerning this. Wisdom is good with an inheritance and profitable to those who see the sun, for wisdom is a defense, as money is a defense. But the excellence of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to those who have it. Consider the work of God, for who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man can find out nothing that will come after him. Another cheerful section from the book of Ecclesiastes. There was a, I think it's sort of faded right now, but there was a while when there was something going around the U.S. called possibility thinking. Imagine yourself rich and imagine the possibilities. I suppose in a similar vein, the power of positive thinking. And what we have in the first four verses is contemplate your limitations. So I've entitled this Limitation Thinking. Verse 2, better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. Did you read that and think to yourself, so, if I have a choice between going to a funeral and a wedding, I should choose the funeral. Is that really true? Verse 3, sorrow is better than laughter, for by a sad countenance the heart is made better. Is it really better to be sad than happy? Should we all be going around with borderline depression? It's rather a dreary thing to say. And how does the first part of the first verse fit in? A good name is better than precious ointment. Well, let's start with that. I spent 2 years with a guy named Eleftherios Venizelos. He was the prime minister on and off of Greece in the first part of the 20th century. 3 different times he's prime minister. And my focus was on his second time, 3 years, 1917 to 1920. I read everything I could find about those 3 years in Greek history, and then I spent another year writing up what I thought I'd found. And Venizelos was a very interesting guy. He's one of the few politicians where I actually liked reading his speeches. They were interesting speeches. He had something to say, and he said it extremely well. And at some point, while he's prime minister of Greece in about 1918, 1919, and Greece is on the Allied side, they're part of the winning coalition that wins World War I, and he's going to go to the peace conference in Paris and have a say in how all of the spoils and the lands, the territories of the losers are going to get divided. And somebody proposed to him that they put up a statue of him in Athens. And he said, don't do that. Statues that are put up while politicians are alive get taken down. Wait till I'm dead and then put up a statue and it will stay. So they didn't put up a statue. He still lost the next election, but they didn't put up a statue. If they had, it would have come down after the next election. He was right. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. And the two parts go together. The point is, a great reputation after you're gone. The sum of your life, what people remember about you, that is a valuable thing that's more valuable than, well, in this case, precious ointment is the comparison. Because your reputation at your death, that can't now be lost by any later actions you do. You can't later on do something stupid and foolish to ruin your good reputation. Why does the preacher recommend limitation thinking? Well, his point is that we learn the most important things in life by facing our limits and accepting them and then living within those limits. When I was in Cyprus, my brother Alan visited us and had been to Spain on his way and had bought himself a really, really fantastic guitar. He was teaching himself classical guitar at the time. And he bought me a guitar, which was not nearly as expensive, but it was still a very good guitar, and brought it to me as a gift. And I sat there in our apartment in Larnaca, and I listened to him play, and I started to play the guitar, and I said, this is fun. And I started to practice. But then I realized, as I practiced for a while, that if I was going to really become good, I was going to have to practice an awful lot. And I did not have time. I was teaching full-time at the academy. I won't go through all the stuff I was doing. I just did not have time. And I can remember realizing I don't have time to properly learn how to play the guitar. That I got agitated and irritated with life, that I didn't have time to do what I was enjoying. Until I stopped and I said to myself, you will have a long, long time to do this if you still want to. In the years ahead and perhaps in the next life. And God has so arranged things that you cannot develop all possible talents and pursue all possible interests in this life. It cannot be done. So stop complaining, put the guitar away, and just wait. So that's what I did. Limitation thinking. One of the stupidest things that this country has ever indulged in is the message, especially to young women, you can have it, finish it, all. You can't. You can't. No one can have it all. Now, what's behind the slogan? What was behind my discontent? I can tell you. Behind the slogan is the human desire to be God and to have infinite power, infinite resources, infinite time, infinite ability to do the infinite everything. And the human reaction throughout history to not being God is to say, I want to be God. And people try to look all different ways to evade and subvert the fact that we are limited. We have limited years. We have limited resources. We have limited time in a day. And angry at not being God, the human race goes on. And this is not a modern problem. This is not a modern problem. This is a human problem. And so the preacher says to us, grasp the single most aggravating limit that exists for you. Your days will sometimes just be up. And when it comes, you'll realize your days haven't been that many. And you go to a funeral, and there at the funeral, however great the man, you will be able to hear things or know things he didn't accomplish. At my father-in-law's funeral, my father-in-law was a great man in many ways. I have never known anyone as accomplished as my father-in-law. A world-famous research scientist whose art hangs on our walls, who helped pay his way through graduate school by singing on the radio, who ran a 48-second quarter in high school in the 1920s, who swam at the national levels, who was a football halfback, who published his own poetry. I don't know anyone else. I never knew anyone else like this. And at his funeral, his youngest son read a poem that he'd written in which he tried to figure himself out. How is it that he tried to live three lifetimes in one and failed? And the sad thing is, we can live five lifetimes in one and still not come close to doing all that we might imagine that we'd like to do or wish to do or see and enjoy. Can't be done. Death teaches us this most important lesson of limits. People have asked me, what are you going to do now that you are retired from teaching? And after I've told this congregation, you're to stop asking me that question. You've been very good, and I haven't heard it from people in this congregation. I appreciate that. But I hear it at school. We went to Gretchen's 45th high school reunion yesterday in conversations. I'm retiring from teaching soon. Oh, what are you going to do now? People who've recently been retired, they have advice to give me. One woman is recently retired, and she's filling up her life with stuff she loves doing. She's writing 800-page books of genealogies. I said, that sounds great. No, I didn't. The fact is, I have a list long enough for at least the next 300 years. And however much I get to, however diligent I am, however hard I work, I'm not going to get to all of it. Not even close. These four verses say, how do you live? How do you live a wise life? How do you live before God under the sun, in which everything is condemned to vanity? And the first four verses say, well, get that lesson through your head. Get the lesson through your head. You can't do everything. You can't have it all. You can't pursue all your interests. You can't develop all possible talents that you have within you. You can't see all interesting places you'd like to see. Sorry, George. You know, travel magazines will sometimes publish, you know, the 100 places to see before you die. And somebody else will come up with a different list. He's not saying don't enjoy weddings. Don't enjoy graduations. Don't be happy at births. He's already said, rejoice in these things. But to dwell only on beginnings, to dwell only on potential, to dwell only on possibilities, is not to understand or know life. To know and understand life, besides the comedies, there must be the tragedies. And human life, there's a tragic part to all of human life. Because however noble somebody is, however great somebody is, in the end, death just ruins it, doesn't it? So the best you can look for is a good reputation at your death. He lived well, he died well. And it's understanding these limits that makes us long for and comprehend why Jesus died for us, why Jesus rose again from the dead for us. Only there is there salvation from the vanity of life, only in Christ. I defy you to find any other even offered hope. That will rescue us from the vanity and the shortness of life than in Jesus Christ, who died and rose again. And so the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, remembering what's coming. That's verse 4. Know that our condition is a tragedy. Made in God's image, noble, and we die like the animals. Now, I can hardly think of a more un-American message than these four verses. This country is known around the world for its naive optimism. That's the European view of Americans. That's the Middle Eastern view of Americans. I suspect it's the Chinese view of Americans. A naive optimism that won't pay attention to the tragedy of life. And most Americans, when they're brought face to face, Their reaction is to say, "You old sourpusses." But Ecclesiastes is not on the side of America at this point. Verses 5 and 6 say, "It is better to face the sober truth than to reject appealing deceptions. It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. For like the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity." Which is better, to have a fool sing to you or to have a wise man holler at you? Which is more enjoyable? Well, I prefer the song. Truth often sounds like a rebuke. It sounds harsh and it sounds unfriendly. But lovely, catchy music can spread false ideas and it sure is pleasant to listen to. About 8 or 9 years ago, our school district, in a fit of multicultural adventure, sent all of the teachers off for a two-day multicultural training session. And they paid all the money for the substitutes for us, annoyed us all because we'd rather be teaching our classes, and we went all off in groups of 10 for multicultural training sessions. So, I had my 2 days, and the only thing I remember from my 2 days is a guy about age 30 who had escaped from Cambodia on a boat after the killings in Cambodia in the late 1970s and early 80s under the regime of Pol Pot. His family had been middle class. He was Christian, and he'd escaped. And he came and told us about his life in Cambodia, told us about his escape, was quite gripping, told us about getting to this country and how glad he was to be here. And then he played for us the song Imagine. How many of you know that song? Yes. And it's got this music that sort of carries you along out of this world into some other world. Imagine. Imagine, imagine. And the point of the song in his presentation was, this is what he longed for. And when we got done listening to it, and we'd all sat there mesmerized by the ethereal music, I said to him, I don't know why they ever invited me to these things. I said to him, "Why did you play that song for us?" He told us why. I said, "Don't you realize it's with those ambitions that Pol Pot and his fellows killed all those Cambodians?" I said, "Pol Pot was moved by those ideas. Pol Pot wanted a world without this and without this and without this and without this. And he was ready to kill a million people to get it." He had the courage of his convictions and his hopes and his ideals and his goals. He was a true utopian. Educated in Paris with the best possible French education you can get. Filled with the best ambitions of the French philosophers. Aiming for a world without war, without poverty, without. And that song was exactly the same mentality. And I remember he sat there. This is a Christian, remember. He sat there and he was silent for about 30 seconds. And he said, "I never thought of that." I didn't have Ecclesiastes close to hand, but I'd say, you've been listening to the song of fools. You've been listening to the song of fools. And you just recommended it to us. The song of fools. Who want to transcend all human limitations. Want to transcend and get rid of all human problems without reference to God whatsoever. This is the atheist dream. Get rid of God, we can be God, and we'll create paradise on earth. This is what gave us the Bolsheviks. This is what gave us the French Revolution. This is what gave us the Nazis, actually. Only they have a more demonic twist. They're even worse, actually. The Nazis are messing around with deliberately with demonic stuff. But this is what gives us Pol Pot. This is what gave us Mao Zedong. The Song of Fools. Imagine yourself out walking, and it's a cold night, and you need some heat. And over here, you've got one fire, and a person has started this fire with a bunch of dry twigs and branches and brambles. And that fire is crackling away, and it's got sparks burning, and you know how those fires burn. And over there, somebody's built a fire with a few little twigs here, and then some larger logs of wood around. And it's not making much noise, and it's not putting out much fire, and it doesn't look like much. Which fire do you want to stay by all night long? The human race, in its tragedy, always chooses the wrong fire. They go over to that crackling fire, and they sit down, and it feels warm for a moment, and then it's gone. Another fire doesn't look like much. For like the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity. You know, evil teaching can be made attractive. People are fooled all the time. They think, well, if the teaching sounds good, must be good. That's why we read, Second Corinthians. Paul says in 2 Corinthians, he says, Satan can dress himself up like an angel of light and deceive people. So no wonder you there in Corinth like the false teachers. They come in, they teach this and that. You say, well, it's not like Paul. And you're ready to listen to them and be happy. He doesn't quite say to the Corinthians, you fools, but he's pretty close to it. I have a proposal that you will like for changing the American Constitution. All right, this is a great proposal. I propose we amend the American Constitution to ban and outlaw unemployment. Anybody, you like that idea? I think it's a great idea. Just change the Constitution and make it unconstitutional to have unemployment. I have a book I'm going to write in my retirement. How to lose weight on a pancake and chocolate diet. Now, if you have enough sense of reality to think there might be a problem with either of those proposals, that's good. Do you know the whole country, by and large, bought into a book with this title? How to be happy by following no rules at all about sex. The whole sexual liberation, that's a long time in the past. But the effects are still with this country all over the place. And it hasn't produced happy women. It hasn't produced happy children. And it hasn't produced a happy society. And back in the late 60s, that was the song being sung. It was sung in all kinds of different ways. Who can resist a slogan like this? Make love, not war. Often the crackling of the thorns under the pot appeals more than truth until the poison works and people are hurt. let's go back in the U.S. to 19. I was taking a class at school recently. I forget why. They like it. I was just reading old advice that my 2002 calculus students gave to my 2003 calculus students. And I'm going through papers to throw them out. So I picked up, I had them write words of advice. And so there were various words of advice. Things like, very good advice. Things like, do your homework. And then they had lots of variations on do your homework. Do your homework at home. Doing it in study hall is useless. Copying homework for this course is useless. This course is not like any math course you've had before. You can't figure it out during the test. Right? These are smart kids. They used to be able to do that. Right? So there's loads of advice. If you think you don't have to memorize the formulas, go take the foods course. That's my favorite. And along in there was... when Mr. Edgar tells you to learn something, do it. And get him to tell lots of stories. So I interrupt my classes with stories a lot of the time. What I do is, my best class ever got the fewest stories ever. Because I use the stories when they get looking bored. So when they start looking bored, I stop, tell a story, and I get their attention back again, and then I go back with the mathematics. By the way, that was Sam Boyle's approach to evangelism in China. He used to start drawing cartoons, draw a big crowd in a village. He'd get the big crowd. He would jump down. The evangelist would step up. He'd start preaching. After a while, the crowd would start to disappear. The evangelist would jump down. Sam Boyle would jump up, start drawing cartoons. The crowd would gather, and he would go back and forth. That was the routine. I actually do it with you guys, too. I was telling a story about my years at Swarthmore. 1964, you can hardly believe this. Swarthmore is known then as one of the more liberal campuses. Around here it was known as Moscow on the Krum, the Krum being the river that goes through it. When I got there, there were rules way more strict than Geneva's rules now about visiting men and women in their dorms back and forth. It's a little startling to think that Swarthmore 1964 was more restrictive of its students and their contact with the opposite sex than Geneva College is now. There was a new concession just given in 1964. Women could visit in men's dorms Saturday night till 11 p.m., doors open, feet on the floor. And it was enforced. By my junior year, there were no rules. It was like that. And, you know, there had to be adults in charge who knew this was going to have some bad effects. Why do the wise, some ways, sometimes just give way before falling? Why do the wise sometimes just sit back and say, all right, have it your way? And verses 7 to 10 are four tools by which the wise get silenced. Oppression, bribery, fear, and self-pity. Those are four ways that wise people suddenly just shut up and let the fools run the show. Now, when the wise embrace folly, it stinks. And Proverbs says this in several places. So does this book later on. Why do the wise do it? Well, fear. Do you know, fear destroys reason. When you're afraid of somebody, you are thinking, how do I survive? Not what is good, what is right. I'm sure you've run into this. You've had situations where suddenly you're afraid and you just don't think very clearly. Well, let me just use as an example college campuses in 1965. What were the administrators afraid of? I can tell you. In fact, I could ask Jan. She could tell you. I asked Joe. He could tell you. They were afraid of the students. Because students across the country were suddenly sitting in people's offices and nobody quite knew how to handle them. They were having little mini riots. There's a little joke in our district about junior high kids walking out of school in protest in 1973 about something. Now, you can't imagine that today, can you? Can you imagine doing that at Penwood? No. Can you imagine having done that at Upper Darby? I don't think so. But students had gotten power into their hands in 1965, 66, and the war had something to do with it. And administrators were just afraid. Plus, they weren't very strong people. And they said, well, all right. And making it harder for administrators, a lot of the faculty sided with the students. In fact, you can go to any campus and find out, you can see what a person taught and know which side the faculty were on. If they taught English, they were on the student side. If they taught history, they were on the student side. If they taught political science, they were on the administration side. How come? Well, the political science people understood power politics when they saw it. And they said, this is nasty power politics. The engineering people wanted everybody to go away and let them teach their engineering. The art teachers were out in front with their signs. But fear, it was fear that produced the adults just stepping aside and saying to the youngsters, have it your way. And I know a lot of those adults knew that what the youngsters wanted was stupid. So fear. Now, sometimes the fear comes from the government side. All right, fear can come from lots of different directions, so I'm just picking one place. But when you're afraid for your job, when you're afraid for your life, when you're afraid for your reputation, when you're afraid for your belongings, and your fear is moving you, sometimes you turn spineless. And then you simply listen to the laughter of fools and let them have their way. Bribery. Bribes. They work. Did you know that? Bribes work. Yeah. Hand somebody a little bit of money or a lot of money, and sometimes you can get some foolish things. I do think an awful lot of our legislative accomplishments in the last, I'd say 150 years, a great deal in the end in the fine print to bribery. Sometimes disguised bribery, sometimes open bribery, but bribery. Why do we get governments to do such terribly stupid things? Somebody gets money from it. Now, bribery works best if it works in private. You want to keep it silent, you want to keep it secret, so most of the times it doesn't come out. But let's just take a recent example. We've mentioned this before, but it's current in the news. How bribery produced folly and made the wise foolish. Those judges up there in northeast Pennsylvania, sending away a bunch of teenagers for 90 to 180 days as legal, right? Getting bribed by the private prison operators to send them as many students as possible, as many young people as possible. All right, finally uncovered, but it's strictly a monetary thing. Bribery's behind it. You know, the higher you rise, the greater the temptation is to protect your position. That's true in academia. That was true in the Communist Party. That's true in business. That's true in journalism. It's true in politics. It's tough having climbed up a certain amount of rungs. There are a lot of people who want to replace you. And there are a lot of opportunities. My school district, we had, back two or three superintendents. She was determined to be a good and effective superintendent. I knew her personally. She taught in my high school, and she became superintendent through just absolute demon hard work. So she became superintendent, and then she was an example, and I thought she was going to be this way when she became superintendent. She was an example of what's called the Peter Principle, that people get promoted to the level of their incompetence. She was, another way to say it, she was over her head in this job. And to be superintendent of Westchester, you've got to be able to balance a lot of things. And while she was superintendent, not only did her marriage fall apart, but people who wanted to sell things to the district found that she was an easy touch for clothes. And so they gave her gift certificates to buy clothes in larger and larger sums. And finally, when she was off at a different district, having gotten canned at our district, she was off up in New England someplace, another superintendent, it came out that it sure looked like bribery. My guess is she didn't realize she was being bribed. She thought people would just be nice, offering her this, offering her this. Sure, thank you. Sure, thank you. You say, how could somebody be so naive? Oh, it's easy. Because the people offering the bribes are pretty clever. They're pretty smooth. They're not making the close connection. But it turned out a lot of Westchester's vendors had provided her with lots of extra goodies. So when this came out, she was so humiliated, that very thoughtful woman that she was, she wrote a very nice letter to her cleaning lady saying, I'm very sorry, and it's too bad you're going to have to deal with this, but I have no choice. And she committed suicide, living alone. She'd risen high, and she didn't even realize, I don't think, this is my take, she didn't realize she was being bribed. And then there it was in the newspapers, and the Attorney General was looking into it in our area, and she was going to be indicted. You know, there's a reason the Bible says pray for kings and all in authority. It's tough. It's tough being in those spots. It's one of the reasons a lot of the teachers in my school love just being teachers. They don't want something more. Our time is up. There are two more things that destroy people's good sense. One is anger, and one is self-pity. And we'll talk about anger and self-pity. And then two protections. Two protections that are there in verses 11, 12, and 13. But let me conclude. How should we live as believers in a world condemned to vanity? Answer here. Attend to the limits God has imposed, and this will drive us to Christ. And accept the hard truths of the wise over the songs of fools, and reject failed human answers to human problems. And we'll say more this afternoon about it, but be very careful of the four tools used by the proud and the fools to deceive the wise and to get them to stop being wise. And those tools are fear, bribery, anger, and self-pity. And as I said, we'll talk more this afternoon about it. So how should we live? Well, fear God, enjoy His gifts, look to the end of the matter of Jesus' return, and remember your Creator in the days of your youth, as the book concludes.